Meanwhile, back at the ranch here with Reed and Nancy Feldman. Can somebody tell us about Mrs. Feldman's demise and the legal consequences therefrom? Oh, yeah, okay.
Can you clarify the role Staffy played in the chapter 1 verse 3? I found out that sentence number 1 doesn't pretend to, intended to kind of dictate certain types of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
obviously the legislature plays a different role in, you know, in Chapter 1, the specification of a standard of conduct, saying, in effect, thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do that, that way of specifying conduct shapes what we think about the standard of reasonable care. If the legislature tells you to do something, then, again, according to Cardozo, presumably failing to do that is a lack of reasonable care, or tells you not to do something, then doing it is a lack of reasonable care. On the other hand, in Chapter 3, there's a much more direct role in which, first of all, as the courts have interpreted it through cases like Moraine versus States Marine Lines, the courts view themselves as being dependent on the statute to create a remedy. That in the absence of a remedy created by the statute, the courts have no inherent authority to shape a remedy according to their own best judgment. Now, again, part of the we saw the historical origin of that, and in Moraine versus States Marine Lines, we have a case in which we have, in effect, unclaimed territory. No one staked out this territory, and the question is, do the courts have the power to create a remedy for death on the inland waterways? And Congress, the Supreme Court says, in effect, well, Congress's silence on this point doesn't prevent us from doing the right thing. Debatable question, but that's what they do. It would be far different if the Supreme Court were being invited to, in effect, amend the Death on the High Seas Act to correct some mistake that Congress had apparently made in the drafting of that statute. Then the court might say, look, we were ready to create a remedy where there had been silence, but if a legislature wants to create remedy A, we're not going to pretend that we can rewrite that so that it's A plus one. Now, the example I gave of the California judge who said, in effect, the remedy as written by the legislature is restricted to people who are legally married, I don't think that goes anymore. I think that the modern understanding of intimate relationships is such that it can't be restricted to people who are married in a traditional way. Now, it happened that the trial judge was right about gauging the temper of the times, but the question of whether that was constitutionally limited or not wasn't ever resolved. The legislature stepped in and essentially cleared that up. But the relationship is still one in which the court is looking to the legislature for direction rather than the judge having the power or judges in the form of a court. And again, this is the ongoing dialogue of saying, well, what powers do judges have? How do those powers relate to such things as statutes or constitutions or other sources of authority. It's a very, you know, big, very important issue. You know, Lawrence versus Texas. Is that a good decision? Is that a bad decision? Why? So again, for our purposes here, I want to be clear that as you look at a fact pattern and you are asked to advise a client, you want to first look to the statute with respect to that wrongful death recovery and say, what has our legislature decreed? If I got a simple case where I represent Mrs. Rice, she's got a boatload of economic damages, they're all clearly authorized by the legislature, or do I have a more difficult case in which I've got to qualify my client in a statute that's a little bit murky perhaps? I've got to do a little bit of bobbing and weaving here to get my client in line in front of the cashier's window. And then I've got to fight over the definition of what they get and what they don't get. So your primary task here is to make an assessment. I think it was last year, maybe it was last summer, I can't remember when I gave this exam, I had a case in which a guy had like 11 glasses of schnapps or something at some New Year's Eve party, gets in his car, is going the wrong way on the freeway, and wipes out a family, mother and two children, in a minivan. And the primary question on the exam was, I mean, there were questions about punitive damages, there were questions, it wasn't exactly, gee, I wonder if this would be considered a violation of the standard of reasonable care. You know, that part was a gimme, but the tough part was, well, who gets to recover? And the beneficiaries were the grandparents of the children who were killed. As I recall, they were the lone survivors here. And the question was reading the statute to figure out, did they qualify or not? How was the statute written? So, again, the challenge in these kinds of cases is, can I read the statute, make any sense of it, and at least identify the issues to say, well, for my client, the issue is, do they qualify under the statute? Here's a provision of the statute that seems to support my claim. But here's another provision of the statute that makes me a little bit worried. If the court thought this provision of the statute meant this opposite thing, I'm in trouble. My clients are in trouble. Part of what I want to illustrate here is the way in which the courts take ambiguous statutes and try to make those ambiguous statutes serve some kind of sense of fairness or public policy. It's part of what's going on in the Feldman case. But again, recognize that in many cases, the judges don't particularly want to be at the center of the question. You know, for example, do unmarried couples have the same rights as married couples, or what about the restriction of legal marriage to heterosexuals? You know, is that something that's a good thing or a bad thing, constitutional, unconstitutional? Most judges would say, you know, I don't want to be the one who's deciding that question. I'll take orders from my boss as to whether this statute is an okay thing or not okay thing. And again, as you look at these statutes, some things are going to be relatively straightforward. Others are going to be very challenging, and you want to just kind of wade into them and see what good you can accomplish in terms of clarifying the status of your client and the likelihood that they're either going to have to pay out money or that they'll be able to recover money, depending on whether they're defendants or plaintiffs. Okay, so let's talk about Mrs. Feldman and the Connecticut statute that compensates. Ms. Russell, I'll have to start paying you overtime here. Okay, go ahead. Okay. And in what capacity? We talked before about choice of law issues. In this case, which state's law applies? We are applying the law of what state? Yes. It turns out they were living in Connecticut at the time, and the crash occurs in Connecticut, so there are all kinds of reasons why Connecticut law should apply. You can imagine if the plane had crashed in Maine, or if they had been, all sorts of different, and because of the different variations in state statutes, you can imagine, again, the incentive for forum shopping for a plaintiff where the choice of law is up for grabs, that the plaintiff would go shopping for the most favorable wrongful death statute and see if they could get that state's law to be applied to the case. But everybody agrees that it's Connecticut law that applies here. And under Connecticut law, what is the remedy for wrongful death? I think there's more clearly a survival action here. So the remedy is to the estate of Nancy Feldman, and Reed Feldman, her widower, shows up in his capacity as executor of her estate. If Nancy, for example, had, again, just hypothetically speaking here, if Nancy Feldman had a brother with, you know, some physical or mental disability, and Nancy had money of her own from her family, let's say, and before she and Reed got married, she made sure that the money in her, you know, under her control was all designated in the event of her death. All the money that she had would go to a fund, a trust fund, to support her disabled brother. Well, we might have a different kind of case here, but as it turns out, all the money's going to go to Reed as her husband, and whether it had been set up as a wrongful death thing for the spouse, et cetera. As in the Rice case, we don't have a conflict here between a wrongful death act kind of case and a survival act case. They all sort of point in the same direction. But again, just so you're thinking about it, it's certainly possible for these two things to go in different directions. Okay. So, Nancy dies, there's a survival act recovery on behalf of her estate, that's the who. Now let's talk about the what. Under the Connecticut law, what is the measure of damages? Okay. It's kind of a mouthful. Now, the first thing that you mentioned, economic loss, is pretty universal. There's nothing very controversial about saying that the economic loss suffered as a result of this death should be recoverable, again, either by the estate or by designated family members. But in addition to this economic loss, you said there's this other thing about the... Say that again. Okay, remunerative activities are economic activities. I go to work to get remunerated. It's a large part of my motivation in addition to the sheer pleasure of doing this. But it's the remuneration that gets me up in the morning. Okay, but there are non-remunerative activities that don't generate any kind of a wage, but but I'm motivated to engage in those as well. So the Connecticut statute says, unlike, notice again, unlike the Pennsylvania statute, which says only remuneration deserves recovery, Connecticut says, oh, and by the way, you get to recover for the loss or destruction of the capacity to enjoy life's non-remunerative activities. So this is a kind of non-economic recovery. In this case, it's sort of the loss of, you know, life's whatever these. You could also try to generate a recovery for, or you could authorize a recovery for the destruction of relationships. Again, this loss of consortium, society and companionship. In particular, many legislatures recognize that with respect to the death of children, if you restricted the recovery to the economic loss suffered when a child of yours is killed by somebody else's negligence, well, there's no economic loss. If anything, quite the opposite. You know, my children show up in the liability column in terms of economics rather than in the asset column. But that would, you know, to leave it at that would be wrong. So we say, I want to recover for the loss of the society and companionship of my children. That's the loss I would suffer. But again, the legislature may choose to include that, and the legislature may choose not to. Connecticut has gone in the direction of non-economic damages to the extent of doing this loss of... So what generates the appeal here? Tell me why we're fighting at the level of the appeals court. Okay, now let's look at the overall nature of the evidence upon which this award will be based. This is where we put on our cap, sort of as fiction writers here, and we start imagining the Nancy Feldman story, starting from the day that the plane crashed. Going forward, in terms of her economic situation, well, you know, first she goes into the hole here, paying for her law school education. Then she emerges from Georgetown Law School and goes into the plus column. And then what's the rest of this story? Okay, then the theory is that she's going to go back to zero again for 8 years, then she's going to go back to work and go on earning, you know, more money. We, again, chart this economic story as best we can, and as you move earlier and earlier, suppose Nancy Feldman has not yet been accepted at Georgetown Law School, but has talked to all her friends. She's taking a year off after graduating from college to do this, that, and the other thing. Then she's going to go to law school. Or she's a junior in college, and all of her teachers tell her, Nancy, you'll make a great lawyer. Or she's just graduating from high school. She's the, you know, you keep moving further back in time in the Nancy Feldman story, and you're writing more and more fiction. But as we've talked about earlier, what else are we going to do? Here it's relatively easy to project the earnings because we have the basis of the average earnings of a person who graduates from Georgetown Law School. But it's still speculative. Was Nancy admitted to Georgetown by the skin of her teeth? Was she offered a huge scholarship? Was she, you know, I mean, you could start fiddling around with that to say, was she interested in mergers and acquisitions? Did she want to be, a public defender? Was she, you know, what was her interest in law? Where's she going with this? economically. Now, in addition to that, of course, we have this other thing of life's non-remunerative activities. In this case, we're focusing primarily on, you know, her 2.3 children that statistically speaking she would have had. And again, you know, we would want to take evidence, I suppose, on what Nancy had said, you know, when she went out with her college roommate a week before the plane crash, and they were talking about the future and, you know, what they said about, you know, are you and Reed thinking about starting a family and, you know, what's your blah, 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 and whether Nancy says, well, you know, we want to have children someday, but, you know, it's really not the right time, and Reed's a little, I gotta wait till he's really ready for this, or versus, gee, we want to have 8, you know, zillion children and, you know, whatever. All of these things, again, would be relevant to figuring out. And obviously in 1971, when the plane crash occurs, in 1973 or whenever this case gets tried, the idea that a woman who has children is going to take 8 years off as distinguished from having children and telecommuting, you know, continuing her practice working at home, or that she's going to have child care, go into the office. Again, the evidence that she'd just been listening to Dr. Laura, and, you know, Dr. Laura says, you know, I mean, all of these things, again, become relevant to, well, what do we project here? Now, in view of all this messy stuff, what does the trial judge do? Yeah, the trial judge says, in effect, let's just sort of swap these out here. Let's assume that at a minimum, whatever she would have made as a lawyer is less in her mind than the value to her of this child rearing, which, again, we're kind of making up out of whole cloth here, how many children she would have had and how she would have managed all of that. So the trial judge says, let's just treat this as though we're all as though we're all economic damage. Makes an award on that level, and Allegheny Airlines appeals that. And what does the appellate court majority say? Yeah, basically, you can't just throw this all into a big pot. You've got to segregate the non-economic damages from the economic damages into a separate calculation of that. I mean, the trial judge could get this back and say, fine, Allegheny Airlines, you're going to take me up on appeal and show me I'm not, you know, all right, I've done a separate calculation and it's $400,000, you know, now it's going to be twice as much. See if you like that. There's a concurring opinion by Judge Friendly, however, or Judge Not So Friendly, depending upon your perspective here. By the way, there are two Friendlies. There's Fred Friendly. You may have seen on they keep rerunning, and it's a very good series, The Constitution, That Delicate Balance. He's sort of the host of this a series. It's a PBS series where they have, you know, sort of a quasi-law school Socratic method kind of thing where they talk about hypothetical deals. And anyway, Fred Friendly is his brother, Harry or something like that. I can't remember. Anyway, he's a distinguished judge on the Second Circuit. So you periodically come across this character. Now, he concurs dubitante. I always think of that as an aperitif, it's dubinet, I guess it is. But he concurs sort of with misgivings here. And what's the source of his misgivings? Okay, part of it is his, I mean, this is a very, again, we get right into the culture war here about what is the most plausible scenario, the most logical thing to expect of Mrs. Feldman. And in Judge Friendly's world, the logical thing for Nancy Feldman to do, if her husband's doing reasonably well in his law practices, Mrs. Feldman would do what any logical woman in that situation would do. She'd sit home and polish the silverware while her husband's off making money. Now, again, you know, to modern sensibilities, this seems incredibly stupid, but there's nothing inherently right or wrong about these choices from the standpoint of making predictions about the future. It's not so much about saying what most people will do, it's we're trying to figure out what Nancy would do. And again, we're stuck trying to piece together what Nancy would do based upon fragmentary intimations that come from that, you know, meeting with her old college roommates, having lunch in which they, you know, unburden themselves to one another about their lives and their, you know, in a, you know, chick flick kind of, you know, sharing of worldview kinds of things. And that's where we try to figure out, okay, what would Nancy have likely done? Yeah. No, it's for the jury to make. Now, in this case, we get an appeal. The case was tried to a judge, apparently. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe neither party requested a jury. For whatever reason, it wasn't decided by the jury. It was decided by the judge. But the same factual inquiry of trying to figure out the methodology, what methodology we follow in coming up with these numbers, the majority says, in effect, it's for the trier of fact, the judge in this case or the jury in other cases, to simply decide what they think would be the most likely scenario. Judge Friendly's dubious, his unease in his concurrence stems not only from his sort of patriarchal views about the role of women, but also from his sense about equity here. Judge Friendly is looking at this other family in this plane crash and asking himself the question, on what basis does Reed Feldman deserve more money than this, what is it, the Carter family? Or Perry, the Perry family. There, we have a family with dependent children. They lose, isn't it their husband? Yeah. Survived by a dependent wife and five children. Their family gets $369,000. Mr. Feldman gets $560,000. The reason? Well, Mr. Perry wasn't going to law school. And Judge Friendly says, okay, but I'm not sure that... he says, in effect, there's something wrong with this picture here. That as we calculate awards for people who occupy... this one's in seat 15E, this one's in seat 11A... as we calculate the awards that these different passengers on this plane get, it doesn't seem quite right that it's all about their essentially their economic status in life. What about the people who were killed in the World Trade Center bombings in the 9/11 case? You may have read about the controversy over those cases, a publicly created compensation fund to try to short-circuit any kind of tort claims. Wiped out all the tort claims, created a huge compensation fund, but now we have to figure out who gets what. The firefighter who's going up the stairs to try to rescue people in the building, as compared to the stockbroker that's up on the 34th floor. Stockbroker gets $5 million. Firefighter gets $250,000. Is that the way it works? Is that our public policy? Well, okay, you know, in same problems about, you know, stockbrokers engaged, not married. A stockbroker next to him has a long-standing, steady relationship. They were talking about getting married. You know, you start, again, shading from, you know, shades of gray in this area. What kinds of relationships count in terms of compensation? Do you say to the people that are engaged but not married, sorry, you're not married, get nothing? Do you say, well, the engaged people get money but not the people who were talking about it? What about the couple who lived together? Both had had unsuccessful previous marriages. They wanted to wait a long time before they finally went through the process of getting... Who counts? Stepchildren? You know? Spouses, separated, divorced? Who wants that job? But somebody's got to do it, as they say. Dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. How do you decide, again, as a matter of public policy, where you're going to put the emphasis? It's tempting to focus on economics because economics are things about which we have a greater degree of confidence. I feel a greater sense of confidence in predicting what Nancy Feldman would have earned had she lived than trying to assess. Suppose I show you that Yale Law School graduates who move to Washington, D.C. with their lawyer spouses have a 1 in 4 chance of being married in 10 years. What do I do with that information? You know, or if we're playing the statistics game, do we want to play that game? So, again, the more I think about this, the less I want to think about it at all. But again, as you look at the tort system making these determinations, you have clients who walk in your door, they have complicated situations. What are you going to do for them? How much of this do you try to incorporate into the search for compensation? Questions about the process or how to make these assessments? Again, as you look at the prior exams, look to see how well you're doing in recognizing the issues, reading the statute, finding what you need to know, identifying the boundaries where you say, well, I think this, but I'm really not very sure. It's kind of muddy and murky to me. Maybe this, maybe that. When you're at that point, better to acknowledge it than to pretend you know stuff you really don't know. And so, again, as I say, in the part of what I'm testing here is not just what you know and what you don't know. I'm testing whether you know what you know and you know what you don't know. Sort of the Socratic, that's the ultimate Socratic method. Socrates never claimed to know anything. Socrates claimed, I, perhaps alone amongst my contemporaries, know that I don't know anything. And that puts me light years ahead of the people who claim to know stuff they really don't know. So, again, as you wade into this stuff, getting better at knowing what you don't know is as valuable as knowing things and applying them. Questions about that process generally? Yeah. That's better. that's better than the expression that trial lawyers sometimes refer to as, you know, you throw a bunch of spaghetti up on the wall and you see if any of it sticks. You know, I'll sort of throw these theories out and I might be right on one or two of them, but better that, you know, I kind of give it a try than that I not do anything at all. I don't think that's better. I think it is better to say it might be one of those exceptions. The problem I'm having here is that I need a theory which applies when the plaintiff knows somebody caused their injury but they can't identify which one it is. It's either alternative liability, concert of action, enterprise liability, or market share liability. It's one of those four, but I can't tell you which one it is. Well, I think it would be better to say, I guess what I have trouble with is, if you're at that point, the Socratic beginning of wisdom, then it's relatively easy, in my perspective, to make progress at that point to start asking the question, do I have all the, am I dealing from a full deck here? Do I have all the players who might have caused the injury? If so, I'd have a good case for alternative liability, assuming I can show all of them are negligent and all of them are in the courtroom. Or, do I have some kind of agreement amongst them? Did they, before this tortious activity occurred, did they communicate with one another in such a way that I could say, you know, whether it's Robert De Niro Ben Stiller, you know, raising fingers at one another to do a drag race? Or number three, is there some kind of trade association that's met that they had an... Or number four, is this a fungible product that I could divide up? That would tell me, based on the facts I have, where I thought the strongest avenue would be. And if you gave me a discussion evaluating this one's not so good, this one's better, this one I think is the most promising, this one's not going to work, that's an A answer. Again, many times, on that point, I should say, many times what lawyers, again, this is what lawyers, experienced lawyers do, is they say, I can get this far. Beyond this point, it's in the hands of the jury. It depends on the jurisdiction. It depends on how these facts fall out, whether the jury finds this witness credible or not. If I can get this expert qualified to give his opinion that this medical condition was caused by this chemical exposure. So many of the statements that I make are in this conditional form of, I'm assuming this to be the case, but it may not be the case. But if it were the case, it would lead to this consequence. And I think as you read the sample answers, you will find much that's expressed in that form, rather than this applies, this doesn't. I might say, just by way of digression, that I was off teaching the bar exam, the review process for these people studying to take the bar exam over in Seattle, and the bar exam is very different. The bar exam is boom, boom, boom. It's like slalom skiing, you know, where you carve these sharp turns and you go boom, boom, boom. It's very, there's no subtlety to it at all. There are 15 issues in a 1 hour, you know, and you just got to go. And I tell them right up front, this is not like law school. In law school, I want all these little subtleties and, you know, possibilities, and gee, this is an interesting society. It's just on the fringe of deciding whether this kind of relationship counts and blah, 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 blah. Ain't no subtlety to the bar exam. But there is subtlety here. And in fact, I want you to display that, because that to me is what makes successful lawyering. Many times as a lawyer, you're caught. I might just tell a little story. One of my all-time heroes in the practice of law was the guy I met when I came to Spokane and interviewed. He's a graduate of this institution. His name is Gene Annis. He's the second half of the firm of Lukens and Annis downtown. I had the privilege of working with him for 4 years. And he gave me a lot of responsibility. He had a lot of confidence in me. Why, I don't know, but... he would give me stuff, and I'd go work on it, and he then had and has maintained a very high reputation as being a very good lawyer. And I was working on this problem, and I came to a point where there was a fork in the road, and I had to pick this way to go or that way to go, and I couldn't figure it out. So somewhat embarrassed, I knocked on his door late in the afternoon, and I said, "Do you have a minute?" He said, "Yeah, what's up?" And so I refreshed his memory about the details of this case and explained the problem that I was in, and I said, I either need to do this or I need to do that. You know, what should I do? And he looked at me and said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "No, you don't understand. I tried, it didn't work. You know, give me the answer." And he said, "No, I don't know." And I sort of, this sort of abyss opened up underneath my feet, and I realized, uh-oh, you know, we're going to jump into this together, and we have no idea whether it's going to turn out to be the right. It could be a disaster if I move the wrong way, and it could be. And I suddenly realized, oh, that's what it's like. You know, there are some things where this is the thing to do. This has worked in the past. This is the thing you do. And then there are a lot of cases where you simply say, I don't know, let's jump, see what happens. And so it's. Getting yourself ready. Obviously, you want to reduce the number of those cases as much as possible because you don't want to look back 6 months later and look back and say, "Did I do that? What was I thinking? Why didn't I see that this would lead to that and that would lead to that?" But many times you are just kind of and again, the sources of that uncertainty are often mixed. If I'd taken that deposition in Cleveland for 3 days, which I had scheduled, but then I canceled because I didn't think we could afford to do it, and it conflicted with this other thing. But maybe if I'd taken that deposition in Cleveland, I'd know the answer to this question. Should I have done that? Is my client going to sue me for malpractice because I messed this up? Should I have studied that harder in law school? Should I have found out more about this judge? You beat yourself up because I feel like I ought to know this, but I don't. And the same thing can happen as you're taking the law school exam. Maybe I can't read this statute because I'm too stupid. You know, maybe I shouldn't have come to law school because I didn't get, you know, my LSAT score wasn't what I hoped it would be. It doesn't matter. When you're in that situation and you're starting to internalize and personalize all of this ignorance and to treat yourself what you have to say is, for whatever reason, maybe the smartest judges, I go to Gene Annis, and even he doesn't know the answer. Well, whether he does know the answer or he doesn't know the answer, whether I don't know the answer because nobody knows the answer or because I'm hopelessly stupid, it really doesn't matter. The point is, I don't know. And if I'm honest about that, I have the chance to make progress, whereas if my first impulse is, I can't possibly reveal to people how stupid I am, I got to put on a good front here, that's the beginning of disaster. I did that as a young lawyer. I had clients whom I thought were looking at me like saying, how long do I have to be polite to this guy before I can get somebody I can really trust, because I know the guy, the $200 an hour guy is busy and he's giving me this guy, you know, to sort of, so you can feel that vibe. So your impulse is to say, you know, I'm a top dog here. There's no question I don't have the answer for, you know. So instead of saying, gee, that's a tough question, I'll have to look that up. Think, oh, geez, you know, now the client's going to say, hey, come back when you know something about what you're talking about. I would say, oh, well, I think about yeah. And then I'd go look it up. Oh, no, how am I going to dig myself out of that one? You know, unfortunately, in most relationships, you have the capacity to do that. But again, one of the things I'm trying to teach you in this moment is, at the beginning of your legal career, better at least to be honest with yourself. And in this moment, you can be honest with me, your professor, I will look kindly upon that acknowledgement, which hopefully doesn't stop at that point. Once you acknowledge, gee, I think it's got to be one of these four, but I don't know which one, then you start thinking, oh, well, let me chip away at it. I'll tell you another personal story, which I hope I can get through. My mother, after I was born, this sort of ties into the material we'll cover on Tuesday. I have three older brothers and one younger brother. The oldest of my brothers is 4.5 years older than me, and there are two in between. My mother was then, she was always married to my father. He was a young pastor, made very small, didn't make money. They had no washing machine. And my mother has other emotional issues. But she was, after I was born, she actually did kind of have a nervous collapse. And before she finally gave up, she just kept trying to do too much, which she couldn't do with all the responsibilities that she had. But she kept saying to herself, I will, you know, I'll just wash, you know, the dishes, and then I'll have my nervous breakdown. I'll do the laundry, and then I'll have my nervous breakdown. And I think sometimes you're like that on an exam. Okay, I can't figure out which one this is, but at least I'll identify it. Let me see what I can do with alternative liability, concert of action, enterprise liability, and market share before I give it up. And oftentimes, if you just sort of keep plugging away at it, when you look at the whole thing, it's overwhelming, and your impulse is just to run away. But if you say, I'll do this one thing before I quit, then it's surprising how far you can get just going in that little dimension. And again, this testing process is as much, again, the testing process of your disposition. You're learning to think like a lawyer, maybe learning to feel like a lawyer, in the sense that you often feel overwhelmed by stuff for which you lack the competence, you lack the time, your client doesn't have the money, you're up against these sharks from Seattle who are going to skin you alive, and you're just this one little lawyer trying to shuffle along. Well, you know, in those situations, it is easy to just sort of want to run away, and oftentimes what you have to do is say, okay, I'm just going to do what I can before I collapse. And learning how to function in that environment, showing me you can do that in an exam, is a good sign, gives me confidence that later on, when you face those situations in real life, you will have developed those sort of good instincts about saying, well, I know this and I know that, I can do this, I can do that. I can't do this thing over here. It's too big for me. I'm going to have to get help over here, and I'll do what I can, and then I'll quit. So, we'll see you on Monday.